All right, Travis.
Jake.
I have a burning sensation, and the only balm that can be placed upon it is Fan X Discussion.
Do you have an uncontrollable urge?
Yeah.
I've got an uncontrollable urge.
I like some Devo. Devo, however, was not at FanX.
Nope, they were not.
For the
there had to be somebody cosplaying as Devo at FanX, and
I have an energy dome. I could have.
Do you?
I could have done that. Yeah, I got really into their sort of comeback album, Something for Everybody. It was at a time that I was transitioning jobs, and I saw them on Regis, and I don't even know if it was Kathy Lee still at that point. I saw
they were on Regis.
Yeah. Yeah. They performed
this
on that.
This is post-Rugrats theme for Mark Mothersbaugh?
It would have to be.
Yeah.
This was probably 7 or 8 years ago, maybe.
He gets a lot of work doing that now.
Hey, yeah.
Composing for movies and TV.
Guys like that. But I got way into Devo for a while. I still do enjoy a good Devo tune now.
Every once in a while, you're known to whip it.
Pretty good.
Whip it good.
But that is not FanX discussion.
That is not FanX discussion.
You and I attended. Well, you went full ham on FanX.
I was all in
Saturday.
All in.
So before we talk about the very fun-filled Saturday, what were your other days like?
Thursday was actually pretty crowded. Usually Thursday's not too crowded.
Yeah.
But it seemed like more people than I've ever seen at one of those FanX events for a Thursday.
For a Thursday. Was it last year they did the record-breaking cosplay thing?
Oh, I don't know. I think they kind of try to do that every year, but I'm not sure. But
I was there when they were trying to get that picture taken of everyone all together first.
Yeah, that's pretty crazy. Anything for a world record, right?
Well, I just figured a lot of people showed up for that. But anyway, a lot of people there for Thursday.
Yep. Yeah, it was a busy day. I had that was my Jurassic Park 25th anniversary panel.
And you put that episode up already.
Yeah, I posted that. So
that was really cool.
One of the reasons I decided to post it is because there were so many people there, were people turned away at the door. And that was like the second biggest panel room. And still, it was packed.
It was a real fun discussion listening to different people and what their experiences were like.
Yeah, the panelists on there did a great job. I like to think I did okay. So,
super great, man. Super great.
It was a lot of fun. I had fans in the crowd.
That one wasn't what I would characterize as being like an expertise heavy panel. That was just a have you seen it and do you have opinions on it? Then you can be on the panel.
Honestly, in my opinion, those are the most fun panels to go to. And I know there are other people that have different opinions, and that's fine. There are people that want expertise panels. They want somebody who had something to do with the movie on the panel. I mean, logistically, that's not super realistic to happen a lot at our FanX.
Well, the one I saw,
there are other conventions that can get stuff like that, and we do get some stuff. We have Disney artists and people that worked on movies. I was on a panel with a producer a couple of years ago. And he was very knowledgeable.
Yeah, the one I saw Saturday that was on
Galaxy's Edge at Disneyland.
Edge at Disneyland, the new Star Wars theme park resort. That was really cool, and I saw some stuff that I was not aware of. However, there were kind of questions toward the end and stuff where someone with a little more expertise would have been great. You were definitely there for flavor more than anything.
Right.
To keep things a little less dry. But
and that does tend to happen at some of the panels occasionally.
I guess, and maybe that was more up to the audience of not realizing. Like they had questions that people who weren't from Disney weren't.
Well, some of it is still top secret. Yeah, some of it is stuff that they don't want out.
Oh, certainly.
So, but
robots that will kill us all.
Yeah, I don't get it. I always feel like my role on those panels is to be as knowledgeable as I can. And I don't try to get on panels that I don't know anything about, because there are panels there. There's tons of anime panels. I know nothing about anime or video games. If you listen to this podcast, you know that. I'm super late to the party on those. But so I don't try to get on those kind of panels. I mean, if something happened and they needed a moderator at the last second just to go in and ask questions or something like that, I could do that. But I would also not try to
No, you're a good.
Pawn myself off as an expert.
Like I said, your flavor, you inject comedy to kind of keep it lighthearted. And also, you sort of jump in to inject comedy maybe when things have gone on a little long. You need to transition and you need something to get out of something that's. There was a gentleman that you may hear in the episode who went through the question line twice, and he kind of was not leaving.
Right. I think he was trying to get another one.
By the way, guy, if you're listening, you know what? I appreciate your enthusiasm, but holy moly, there were some people behind you. Like, think about it next time.
Yeah, he was wearing a Golden Girls shirt.
No, you know what? No dirt on you, guy. I know you were very excited, and you were definitely a fan. Just, you know, something for the future.
But the Jurassic Park one was a lot of fun. There was pretty much all the panelists I dealt with this year on panels were great. I have had times in the past where there's some navel gazing going on and people think that they
are the panelists, not part of a panel.
Right. Or they're trying to out comic book guy, the other panelists.
I'm not going to lie. I would have a hard time doing that. I don't think it's because I get that way. And I don't think it's, I want to believe it doesn't come from a place where I'm trying to out comic book someone. It's just that, in a moment I want everyone, I want to make sure I explain, like, so it makes sense to someone. And then I realize halfway through, like, well, if I'm going to tell this about Spider-Man, they need to know about the Clone Saga.
Right.
Like, they're not going to get the full spectrum of what I'm talking about unless they know about the Clone Saga. So
I always think it's important to, first and foremost, it's entertainment. That's the way I look at every panel I'm on as a performance, at least for me. So, I mean, what I do is I try to be funny, but I also do my homework. I don't go up there just to make jokes. And the jokes I make have to do with what's going on in the room or something that somebody just said. It's not like I just sit down and write out a bunch of jokes. That was actually mostly just stuff off the top of my head.
You gave good props. You gave a college speech to a kid, which frankly I think was you pandering to the audience.
When I said it, it wasn't to pander, but then afterward I was like, maybe I need to start pandering because that was a big pop.
Like you said that, and I was like, that's sweet, but holy moly, he had like the audience.
I think there were some women in that crowd that were like,
marriage material.
Well, I don't know about that, but I'm trying to think of a way not to be crass.
Let's just say
there were more reasons for it being humid in there than the heat.
A lot of women had the vapors. That's the non-crass way of saying
it. Oh, the vapors.
Yeah. So, I mean, I guess that's jumping ahead. That was the Saturday panel was the Galaxy's Edge. And honestly, I thought that was really cool. I was pretty interested in going and seeing that, but I learned a few things, and specifically the robots thing, which don't go too far.
Yeah, that video is rad.
We don't want to spoil it for you, but there was some robot test footage that was pretty keen.
It's also a little scary.
And
it is a little bit scary. So Jurassic Park was fun. Then Friday I had noon, I had a Mission Impossible panel. That was also a lot of fun. It was fun to go back and rewatch those movies. Because I had just seen Fallout at the movie theater a month or so ago.
Yeah, I still haven't had a chance to see
it. It's really good. I say this on the panel, but I'm pretty sure it's my favorite Mission Impossible movie at this point.
Yeah.
I mean, one I always loved. Pretty much I love all of them, kind of like the Bond movies. Some are better than others. But I think this is the best one.
You even have love for the redheaded underachieving stepchild that is too?
Yeah. There's parts about it that are just, I called it a Matrix Impossible on the panel because it's stuck in that.
As long as it's not a 90s Matrix Reloaded Impossible.
John Woo, doves flying. It looked like the Matrix meets a Prince video or something.
maybe you can confirm this. I was listening to something the other day and they were talking about the Mission Impossible films, and someone brought up that only a very small portion of those films is Ethan Hunt on a mission. That those movies are like 90% he is being betrayed, or he's rogue, or he's
There's a lot of rogue, and they do that a lot with the Bond movies lately,
like
too.
Just like he's almost never on an actual mission.
That's the same trope that James Bond falls into a lot lately, too.
Yeah.
Is the government, so there's, you know, red tape in the government, and IMF has been betrayed or something going on, or somebody set him up to make it look like he's the bad guy. And it actually started with the original Mission Impossible movie.
I was just going to say,
disavowed.
It had never occurred to me that the Daniel Craig Bond stuff is maybe, you know, scraping just a little bit of the.
There's a lot of Mission going Impossible. Rogue in those. Yeah. Well, I mean, it started.
I don't know. You can maybe go back to some of the.
It goes back to Timothy Dalton, actually.
Yeah, I was going
to
say Timothy
Dalton. When he goes rogue.
Stuff and
in the Miami Vice James Bond movie. Anyway, the Mission Impossible panel, that was a lot of fun. Really good panelists on there. There was a lot of, it was a clip panel. So they showed clips from the movies. And just because you can't see the video, and also I don't know what the rights are as far as playing those. So I'll probably edit those clips out when I air it.
You don't want to record reenactments.
Right. Yeah. So, and then we'll post this with that panel.
Yeah.
So you'll get the reaction of what we just saw and, you know, overall feelings about the Mission Impossible series, but I'll probably just edit those clips out just to avoid any, Mission Impossible entanglements, that is.
Yeah.
And then Friday evening, I had the Avengers Reassembled panel. That was a lot of fun, too.
That one was a lot of fun.
Yeah, it was. There was a kid that asked a question. I'm not going to go too far into it, but it was something that I had never heard before, a theory. I'm going to ask you about it.
Is this because I mentioned to you I was going to tell you about a theory, and I don't even know if we ever got around to talking about that.
I wonder if it's the same theory.
Was it the Soul Stone theory? Well, I think there are multiple Soul
Stone. Oh, the Soul Stone theory came up a lot in that panel.
So to just lightly brush over the one that I had heard was the Soul Stone is going to be the catalyst of like the actors who are like the original Avengers, except for maybe not Thor because he's doing really good, but the actors who... Like, you know, like Captain America, Iron Man, maybe Hulk. Like, the ones who have been doing it for a while. And like, especially in the in the case of Robert Downey Jr. and...
Chris Evans?
Yeah, I was going to say, I've got Henry Cavill on the mind, so I keep thinking that name. Yeah,
yeah, we'll get
Chris
there.
Chris Evans, two guys who seem publicly to be kind of done. Like, so
yeah, I think Chris Evans probably, like I said on the panel, I think he just wants to eat bread. You know, he's probably tired of working out 8 hours a day, being ripped all the time.
There's a great tweet. You ever watch It's Always Sunny in Philadelphia?
I've seen bits here and there.
The guy who plays Mac on that was in fairly good shape to begin with. And then... Mm-hmm. As part of the story, got really fat. And for the upcoming season, he got super, super just crazy ripped. And he has a great tweet. I don't have it in front of me.
Oh, I have seen that tweet. Yeah, I did see that tweet.
Talks about, like, I don't know why people do it. And then just goes through the crazy regimen of all the stuff he had
to
do.
Working out 6 hours a day, eating.
Getting 9 hours of sleep a night. Yeah, don't eat anything that you like. Don't eat after 7 p.m.
And then have a studio pay for it.
Have a studio pay to get the trainer from Magic Mike. Yeah. So yeah, I'll bet Chris Evans is here. But the theory is just that those guys who have done it for long enough and want to be let go, at least for now, will sacrifice themselves to the Soul Stone to get the people who died back, who are going to become the ongoing Avengers.
And they're pretty much all those characters have somebody existing in the universe that could step in and take over that mantle.
Yeah.
So, maybe it's not a forever thing.
Falcon became Captain America in the comics.
Yeah. Maybe they don't die. Maybe they just go away.
I mean, I think we had talked about that Bucky was also a Captain America, but he was a not great Captain America.
I think I've always assumed they're going to die. Maybe Cap doesn't die, but Cap just goes away and somebody else fills in for him.
Yeah.
Maybe 5 years from now, you see another Cap.
Look, I mean, if you've read enough comics, no one ever dies. So
right. Yeah, that's true.
You know, although some of those guys, like Robert Downey, I'm sure is getting a little long in the tooth of just because they die in the movie doesn't mean they never come back.
Yeah, but somebody brought up on the panel, he's a character that could pop into any Marvel movie and inject some energy, kind of like in Spider-Man Homecoming.
Yeah.
He wasn't in it a lot, but when he was in there, you remember those scenes. So that's something going forward. He could just be there as Tony Stark.
And also comics-wise, you know, I think he did end up coming back recently, but it was just an AI of Tony Stark for a while, so he could do cameos, and they've already got the, you know, digital people doing fairly decently. So if you mix that with like a blue light image, it probably can come off pretty well.
So there's this kid, and he came up to me afterward and was talking to me. He was, I don't know, 8 to 10, somewhere in there. Sorry. If you're listening to this, kid, and I got your age way wrong, 19. I apologize. But I guess he was on a panel at KidCon for YouTubers. I guess he's got a YouTube channel. Hey. And he asked about a theory where Loki didn't actually die. The Hulk wasn't on the ship, and Loki was just pretending to be the Hulk.
That's why he
lost to Thanos before Thanos had all of the stones, and that's why he could never turn into the Hulk. That it's been Loki the whole time, and Hulk is somewhere else.
I mean, if you want to believe directors, because they, you know, they can always lie. I think that one of the Russo brothers or someone came out and that was like, you know, had skin in the game in the films, came out and said it's something that has to do with like the Hulk's just sick of being Banner's fall guy.
I don't know. All I know is I told that kid, you just blew my mind, dude.
No, that's... I saw that. I actually saw that, what you were talking about. I saw that theory pop up recently, so...
I like it.
For everything out there. I think Loki's done, so...
I'm fine if he is, but I like the theory.
Because if he was the Hulk the whole time, then what got super, super choked?
What do you mean?
What was it that got super, super choked if it wasn't Loki?
Just a...
Hey, spoilers for the Avengers. Loki got super choked.
Just a... I don't know. His magical doppelganger?
I haven't watched all of the Thor movies, so when he has a doppelganger and that doppelganger gets killed, what happens to it?
I don't know. I mean, in Thor 2, at the end, Thor thought he was really dead.
Yeah, I didn't see... I didn't see Thor 2.
And that was just a copy.
Thor 2.
But Thor like held him in his arms, if I remember correctly. I
think Thor 2 is kind of regarded as Marvel's weakest. Like that and Iron Man 2 kind of battle it out for which one was kind of the biggest.
I want my bird. That's Mickey Rourke in Iron Man 2. I want my bird.
I've tried to erase Mickey Rourke's weird
whiplash.
I've tried to erase his disgusting fingers. Mickey Rourke has weird fingers.
He does.
Watch out.
It's from his wrestler fingers. It's from the movie The Wrestler, where he jams his... Doesn't he, like, punch the slicer, the meat slicer or something?
I don't remember.
So weird.
I can remember I really liked The Wrestler. I don't remember The Wrestler a ton. I just remember, like, this is a really good movie that does a pretty good portrayal of what happens to a lot of ex-wrestling stars.
I remember Marissa Tomei in The Wrestler.
Is she in that?
Yeah.
My memory just
she's in it a lot.
Here's a
secret. She's a stripper in it, Jay.
Is that
Jay? Yeah.
I guess I'm gonna watch the rest. Here's a little secret in
Aunt May was a stripper. And she dated Whiplash. It all ties theories together.
Here's a little secret for me. There are movies that I don't remember any of them. I just remember whether I liked or didn't like them, and made me remember, you know, a little enough to remember what made me like them or dislike them. But like, they're great swaths of them that I don't remember anything of them. I just know if I liked them or not.
Well, that was a very fun panel. I was glad I could be on that again. The panelists were great on there, and then we kind of discussed Galaxy's Edge, which was Saturday, and that was in the big room, 258.
Yeah, it was a really fun panel. Yeah. I really enjoyed that.
That was a lot of fun.
I think that's the first panel I've ever been to. I wouldn't say that I have gone to a ton of FanEx, but I've never stopped to go to a panel. And it was a good time. It was a good, if nothing else, it was a good rest in the middle.
That's one of the advantages to going to panels is you just go sit down, you choose one that you have an interest in the subject.
Yeah, and that was very lucky for that, because it could have been worse. I could have chose to rest before your panel at the Kevin Sorbo one that I walked into and was kind of like, oh, boy, Kevin Sorbo is just bragging about what celebrities he at the very least claims have come up and talked to him about how much they liked Hercules. I think when I walked in, don't hold my feet to the fire on truth about the Kevin Sorbo thing, but he was talking about some celebrity trying to sell him on a way to get better effects in the show. And I want to say he claimed it was Bill Murray that was trying to sell him on how to do Hercules better. I'm like, okay, whatever, Kevin.
They might as well bring back Hercules and Xena. What else?
Not with Kevin Sorbo. They can bring him back with Lucy Lawless. Lucy Lawless is a treasure.
Yeah, Lucy Lawless, she could still be Xena.
She's not
Kevin,
even her just
Kevin
be
Sorbo
Xena.
Can be old Hercules. Yeah,
I just don't like Kevin Sorbo.
Oh, okay. Fair enough.
But Lucy Lawless, like...
His stringy hair.
Is his stringy hair? Does he have stringy hair?
He was kind of like Prince Adam.
He seems like a guy who should have lost his hair.
He was He-Man-y, right?
Yeah. Much as I hate to say it, he probably would have made at least visually a pretty good He-Man.
Not that Dolph Lundgren didn't hit it out of the park.
Boy. Dolph Lundgren wasn't necessarily a bad He-Man. That was just a really bad movie.
Yeah,
soup to nuts.
It was just poorly written.
There's not much you can do when they make a bad movie, and you know. Also, he still, I think his English wasn't real great at that point, and it just
had Courtney Cox.
By the way, that movie that wasn't He-Man. That was
the Masters of the Universe. You're right. You're right. Yeah. Well, we should probably wrap this one up.
Well, I mean, so what was your experience? You got any good stories coming out of the
car? Oh, well, yeah. I mean, it was a lot of fun. We did some photo ops, got to meet Dave Bautista. That was cool. My son actually got the photo ops this time. We got Dave Bautista and then one with Carl Urban, which my eyes were closed. So that was awesome. That's forever.
And I told you, you just tell people I was just thinking about how awesome Carl Urban would be as Indiana Jones in that moment, and they just captured
there
that.
There you go.
Just draw a nice little thought bubble of, you know, a...
He's one of those guys...
Indiana Jones.
He's one of those guys you want to go, dude, you've had a really cool career. I hope you know that.
Yeah. He's been at...
Your Bones, like, you were in like Lord of the
really
Rings,
cool,
you're
really cool
Judge Dredd.
Really cool nerd career. Is he in a Lord of the Rings?
Yeah, he's he's the leader of the Riders of Rohan. What's his name? I can't remember right now.
That's getting into like the third movie, isn't it?
Second and third, yeah.
Yeah, I start getting fuzzy on remember. Like the third movie is the one I've watched the least and have.
He had blonde hair. It was like long blonde.
I'm sure
I'd
recognize it. I just probably wasn't paying attention. I probably didn't even know who he was.
That was like his first big.
Yeah, he's had that. Dredd, Bones.
Yeah.
He's in Thor. He was in...
Right.
Wasn't he in the Riddick? The second Riddick movie?
Yeah. Yep, he was.
That's terrible, but
I think he was a bad guy in that one, if I remember.
One of the necromongers. Anyway, I'm sorry. That's strange.
Is it necromonger or necromancer?
I thought they were necromongers.
Maybe it is monger.
I'm pretty sure they were necromongers because I think it stuck in my head because of what a silly name it was. like most Vin Diesel properties, like just... Something they came up with, you're like, man, this sounds like something a 14-year-old would think was awesome. But at any rate, so you got a picture with him.
We also met Evangeline Lilly, which was really cool.
She seems like she would be very nice.
She was very nice, yeah. She was, I mean, I don't know if you've ever, anybody listening has done the photo ops. It's pretty quick. You're in there, you pose, you hopefully keep your eyes open, and they take the picture. And she was a little more... Hi, how are you? You know, like, it was really nice to meet you type of thing. So,
yeah,
I mean,
the only photo
I know it's only like a few words, but when you have such little time, it would be easy as a celebrity to just stand there. And there are some that wear sunglasses, which I get now because I wouldn't want to be the one that screwed up somebody's picture. Like Bautista was wearing sunglasses. And after the Carl Urban picture, I was like, now I know why these guys wear sunglasses because...
There's that. I would also bet that going through a line, getting flashers in your eyes every couple
of minutes too.
Probably would not feel great.
Yeah, for sure. But also, how many times, if it was me, apparently I cannot keep my eyes open. I've got the My Name is Earl disease, and it would be retakes every single time.
And I've told you about, I have the affliction called grandma eyes, which is in right. it's a genetic issue in my family. Where, well, I have the dual affliction of grandma and grandpa eyes, which is, if I'm not really doing anything, if I'm just taking a normal picture, I have really tired eyes like my dad always did. However, if I try to open my eyes a titch, I get an affliction called grandma eyes, which my mom had and my grandma had, which is you look terrified. You're like, there's no middle ground. There's no normal eyes for me. It's either your grandpa or grandma eyes. So I'm very sorry for what you're going through, Travis.
But she was super sweet. She took a minute just to talk to you. That was pretty cool. And then we also got one with Manu Bennett. So that was pretty cool. He was Slade Wilson in Arrow.
Oh, I think he's I haven't watched Arrow, so I'm not.
He was in Spartacus, I think.
I haven't watched Spartacus either. Yeah. I think that's a Lucy Laws property as well, if I'm thinking of the right thing.
I think so. I think she was in it, yeah.
Heard that one is.
He's a good actor.
Explicit.
Yeah, I think he's from New Zealand. Yeah. So he's got that deep voice with that accent.
Oh, you mean he's British?
Almost. He's like, he was cool, though. He was like, we should do a pose. And I was like, okay. He's like, let's do fists like we're going to punch the camera. And then he's like, no, not that. Let's fold our arms and look cool. So him and my son are like folding our arms looking cool. And for some reason, I like threw my head back so you can see straight up my nostrils and just this giant beard going across the screen. It's funny.
That's great.
So I screwed that one up too.
That's very personable. I imagine that's like just something he's got in the holster that he does a lot. But like everyone feels very special when he does it.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. It's like Disneyland, how they just one little thing during your vacation can make it feel like you were the special person.
Yeah.
So yeah, when a celebrity comes through and does something like that, it's like throwing a jersey to a little kid because they gave you a Coke after the game. Mean Joe Green, you know, it sticks with people.
Yeah. So you also there was a bit of a kerfuffle with the photos at the show.
Yeah, I guess Jeff Goldblum, this is my assumption, got behind and he was only there for one day.
Do you think he was the biggest draw?
I would say probably, yeah. I know Jason Momoa drew really well too, but he had been there before where Goldblum never had. So I think Goldblum, and he was only there one day, was definitely a big deal.
So were those ones you wanted to try for? Were they like too expensive?
Well,
just not your jam?
We were going to try for Momoa. But he was sold out, so maybe he'll come back again. We'll see. He seems to be one of those guys that's cool with doing that kind of stuff.
We're keeping an eye out for you, Jason Momoa.
But I think
there's an axe throwing place by my house. You can come hang out.
I think the Goldblum thing just got a little out of control and made everything behind. And then one of the printers broke, so we didn't get our Batista picture till the next day. Usually, you get your picture and you walk out, and by the time you get to the end of the hallway, they're handing it to you. It's right there.
Huh.
So it was just a mass of humanity waiting to get the pictures, and they were messed up. But
yeah, I saw those spread out on the tables, and I was wondering, like, could anyone just come up? Could I?
In theory,
like, I didn't make it to the Goldblum. Could I just grab a random picture and then just come home and tack a picture of my face to the person getting their picture?
As creepy as that would be, you could have, but if somebody had done that, they were going to make it right. You had until, I think like next week or something like that to get a hold. If you never got your picture, to get a hold of them, and they'll get one sent to you. You'd at least get the digital copy for sure.
Yeah.
But they would also make it right and get you the physical copy. I mean, it's one of those things that's, it sucks, but what do you do?
That's nice.
And I talked to people about it, and they were as nice as they could be. So considering there was a lot of people that were very upset because they were only there for that one day. And I mean, what do you do?
How it goes. I mean,
it's like if you go to Disneyland and you just want to go on one ride and that ride is broken that day. What do you, I mean, that sucks, but
no, when, I might've even told the story on this that, when we, a few years back when we went, they do the Jedi training show, and Gabe really wanted to be one of the kids who got picked. And we were super lucky that, like, I don't remember, I think it was like the third time that we watched one, he did get picked. And that would have, yeah, that would have sucked. But what, if he had never gotten picked, but what are you going to do?
So he did get picked?
He did get picked.
Did he fight Darth Maul?
He fought Darth Vader.
Ooh, yeah. My son fought Darth Maul.
Was he way into it when he did it?
Yeah, he was pretty excited. Yeah, he was Gabe still pretty young. And
Gabe was like way, like all the fluid movements, he was really into it when he did it.
My son was pretty shaky and nervous.
It didn't, it wouldn't have ended up mattering either way, but he got to fight Darth Vader. I was like, yeah, that was the right one to have him fight.
I would put that on an application.
Yeah.
Yeah. To get into college, get a job, whatever.
I'll let him know.
I fought Darth Vader.
He's going to be trying to get a job in the next year or two. I'll make sure he puts that on. Hey, I want to work at Chick-fil-A.
I guess I maybe Darth if Vader, he gets like, a job at a comic book store, it could work, pleasure. You know?
Yeah, sure.
Depends on where you get the job. Right?
Something to keep a thought about. You get a job at FanEx, perhaps.
Yeah, well, it's probably volunteer, but you can do that.
Do you have any other good stories of the days where the days that weren't just us?
Mostly, I mean, it was cool to catch up with a lot of people that I only see at those
events. Yeah, I definitely, in walking around, I learned, oh, Travis knows a lot of these people.
Yeah.
Which was pretty cool.
And there was a lot of people that weren't there because of the whole, what's his name? Tribe of Kings guy. I can't even remember his name, the author.
Maybe that's something
that whole situation.
Maybe there's, okay.
There was a lot of people that opted really, out of doing it this year.
I don't
and that
really
kind
know
of
what
sucked.
That is, and I'm curious about it. So we don't have to talk about this right now, but I'd like to know a lot more about that.
Yeah, we can get into that.
I make assumptions about it. We'll talk about it off the air.
We can get into that later.
That's not FanEx related.
No, not at all. It just kind of sucked that it happened at all because there was a lot of people that I really enjoy that weren't there. I missed them. It was kind of a little somber.
Just a brief, like 2 or 3 sentence of what that is, just in case anyone's curious what happened. Does it matter?
Honestly, I can't remember the guy's name right now.
Doesn't matter.
I
just want to know what happened.
I guess there was an author that felt like he was being a little too toward and kind of putting the moves on her and made her feel uncomfortable.
Richard Paul Evans thing?
Yeah, Richard Paul Evans. That's his name.
All right, we.
So
we
anyway,
need to talk about this off
the handling of it, a lot of people didn't like, and opted to not be a part of this, and it was a big inner controversy, and there's still a lot of
really appreciate that side of the argument, trying to make things better and not just taking their ball and going.
And you know what? Things were better. Trust me. They were very aware of harassment situations and making people feel safe and comfortable. Anybody listening know that it the ball is definitely rolling in the right direction.
Well, I definitely saw on my way in, I saw lots of signage about, it wasn't just about consent. It was several levels of explanation about consent and cosplay and stuff like that.
And we even tried to talk to some cosplayers. Just because we wanted to interview some, and maybe for the next event in April, I actually know some cosplayers, and I should have thought about this ahead of time.
I think that the basement of that is that we didn't plan super well.
We were trying to like stop people in the hallway and say, "Hey, can we interview?"
That was a lesson.
Yeah,
that's fine. And a couple of people did talk to us, and thank you so much to them. We're gonna put those at the end of a couple of the.
I think people felt like we were going to make fun of them or something like it, which we weren't. So just know that. And we didn't. There was a few people that talked to us and they were very nice. And we're going to post those probably at the end of the Avengers panel and at the end of the Galaxy's Edge panel. We'll just throw those on the end of those.
Yeah.
And then next event in April.
Next event, we'll try and get ahead of it a little more.
I think it's 19th and 20th. Yeah, we'll try and set up some interviews with people because I know some people that cosplay that are super into it and I just want to learn more about it. I mean, it's not my thing personally. I don't like dressing up even for Halloween a lot. I mean, I've nailed Hank Hill and Wreck-It Ralph, but other than that,
you didn't nail Wreck-It Ralph so much as Wreck-It Ralph nailed you.
That's true. He wrecked it.
At the show, there were Wreck-It Ralph cosplayers. I kept trying to get you to fight them.
There were people that still call me Wreck-It Ralph once in a while.
Yeah. Speaking of cosplayers, I mean, that's cosplay is something that is endlessly fascinating to me. Walking the floor, because my jam probably my biggest jam walking the floor is I love going into the artist area and just seeing all kinds of, I love seeing people's takes on things. And, I ended up buying a really cool Hellboy poster, an advertisement for Pam Cakes that I really dug on. But, I love seeing, art, really crazy artistic takes on stuff. And I saw a ton of that. And one of the things I run into, because when it's crowded, trying to walk the floor, specifically the intersections, is really dicey.
Yeah. If you're by yourself, you can kind of do it. Like if I was going back and forth, meeting my kids somewhere, I could do pretty good. Just kind of find a little gap and then zip by people. But if you're trying to keep two or three people together, it's hard.
And that was, so I ran into multiple times the same thing of, I would be heading toward an intersection and trying to be polite, trying to look for my spot. And there would be a group of people where they would have one person in the front, the largest person in the front, and people behind them just pushing and someone going, just go, just go, just go. There was that. And then one thing I'd really like to get to with some cosplayers is some people go with really elaborate costumes.
Yes.
And not to single, well, I don't want to single someone out. Someone that I saw that was just walking around the art area had a pretty large papier-mâché mask to their costume. Like full body.
Right.
Taking up a lot of space. And, you know, and I'm like, I think it's great. This is a neat costume. It's great. You're maybe...
Make it collapsible.
Make it collapsible. If you're going to walk the floor, maybe take it off. It, I don't know. Seems slightly less courteous to be walking around when it's crowded when you've got a super elaborate costume. Or maybe I'm on the not so well knowing end of that, and there's like protocols or courtesies for that kind of thing.
I don't know.
I was not built for etiquette and protocol.
I don't know. I was thinking maybe if they put roundabouts in the that big
was,
areas.
You know what? That was actually, you mentioned that in the show, and I would wonder if that would work really
well. Or even tape arrows. Like if you're on the right side, just like a street, if you're walking this way, be on this side. If you're going to go the other way, do the other side.
The matter is, I shouldn't have been crossing. I should have just weaved in and out, and then when I was done, go across and weave in and out the other side.
It gets pretty crazy in there. That's why the last couple of days, I would just rather go to a panel, honestly.
I kind of have complexes about how I complete things and stuff. But regardless, had a great time. Your panels were a lot of fun. Saw really cool art. Saw, you know, really cool costumes. I just enjoy being around nerdy stuff and seeing people being enthusiastic about being nerdy. Saw a lot of cool stuff like that. And then to close out, I guess this was kind of part of the con, to close out our ongoing series of Aqua Chats, neither of us went to that show.
No, neither of us went. Sorry, you Aquabats.
Hey, look, you got my money, so whatever. But so you just had some family hangups. You couldn't make it out.
Yeah, I had two of my kids plus my nephew, and yeah, it would just logistically was gonna be a nightmare.
And I got out of the show and was a little tired and just decided, you know, I think I'd just rather go home and hang out with my family. And then fortunately got home, had dinner, and just got tired in a way that I haven't been in a long time. So
it zaps you. It really does.
If I had been at that show, I think that wouldn't have been a great time. So
at least you didn't get the con crud.
That's something that goes around. I don't get sick very easily.
Oh, that's good.
I'm fortunate that way. I kind of don't. So good on me. So anything else you'd like to say about FanX?
Nope. Just I'm glad I could be a part of it. The director of paneling, Blake Castleman, does a great job. The panels I was on were awesome, honestly. If they said pick four, what would be your top four panels, and you only get to be on four, the four I was on would be my top four panels without question. So I felt really lucky to be on those. All the panelists were awesome. Everybody did a great job. It was definitely one of the better experiences I've had, and I've had some pretty great ones, but this is probably the top of all of them, being at what once was Comic-Con, Salt Lake Comic-Con, now FanX. So it was definitely awesome, and I'm looking forward to doing more. So
you have any forward thinking about what kind of panels you might do next time? Or
I'm not really
going to get ahead of yourself.
Well, like I get to propose them. They'll send out an email, and you can propose panels, and some they take, some they didn't. The Avengers Reassemble, that was one that I proposed. So
it's a good year to do that.
Yeah. So, I mean, right now I'm not really thinking about too many of them.
Just mental catalog. But, I'm trying to think of anything that's coming up like any kind of fan stuff that's converging in the next few months. I can't really think of.
I'm sure once, I'm trying to think.
That's what I'm saying. Is like
Captain Marvel, is that in March or is that in May?
I'm not sure when that is.
I'm hoping it's March.
They did put out some image stuff on that.
Yeah. And they put that out like the day before the Avengers panel. It was perfect.
Scrolls. Did you talk about Scrolls?
Yeah, we got into Scrolls. We got in quite a bit to Captain Marvel. So.
Oh. We'll save some of that discussion for maybe
we're digging deep. Next
thing we're recording, but
all right. Well, let's wrap this one up.
Hey, so for Late to the Party with Travis Tate, I'm Jake, and before my other good friend here signs off, just enjoy the panels that he's gonna put out for you coming up.
Yep, this one will include the Mission Impossible No Fallout panel. So enjoy that. I'm Travis Tate, and better Tate than never.
Dive in. Welcome everybody to Mission Impossible No Fallout, the Mission Impossible series in retrospect. Just a quick show of hands, just out of sheer curiosity. Raise your hand if the first film is your favorite. Own it, nice. Second film. Come on, guys. We don't have any 13-year-old males in the audience. Okay, third film. Until this last one, I would have claimed the third film.
Yeah, I agree.
Fourth film, Ghost Protocol.
All right. It's a good one.
Raise it high for Rogue Nation, and raise it high for Fallout. Isn't that incredible? Six films in, and arguably the best one in the series. So I am Jonathan Decker, your moderator. I am a film critic with Meridian Magazine, and I'm going to let our panelists introduce themselves briefly, what they do, and why they are passionate about Mission Impossible. Before I became a film critic, I briefly, for about a decade, made my own action films, and my first one was a Mission Impossible fan film. So that kicked me off.
I'm Travis Tate. I'm a stand-up comedian, and I host a podcast called Late to the Party with Travis Tate. And I kind of got into the Mission Impossible originally, I'll be honest, with like Inspector Gadget in the self-destructing things. I was like, Dad, what is that from? So we watched, you know, a few episodes of the original series. So I was kind of into it, and then when the movies came out, it was just straight to the moon from there. So I've always been a fan.
Fantastic.
My name is Sheree Alsop. I'm an author of 47 books, and I just love good action and adventure, and Mission Impossible has all of that.
Wonderful.
I'm Mark Abo, and I write local comic books like Salt City Strangers, and I got into Mission Impossible because I like the spy genre like a lot, and I grew up reading the James Bond novels, and anything spy stuff, I just love.
Rock on. Well, this is a clips panel, so there will be discussion, but there's also going to be a lot of action-packed or interesting clips, and because we have six movies to cover in a short period of time, we're just going to dive in. So our itinerary, we're going to talk about with the first film, the direction of Brian De Palma. With the second film, whatever your qualms with it, or if you like it, it is the film where Tom Cruise started risking his life for our entertainment. We do owe it that.
And he did it right here in Utah.
Yeah, including right here in Utah. Third film, we're going to talk about Philip Seymour Hoffman's performance as arguably the best villain of the series. Fourth film, we're going to talk about how the series finally embraced the teen dynamics that was so prevalent in the original series. Fifth film, we're going to explore the comedy and kind of the buddy. There's a lot of buddy comedy stuff in Rogue Nation that a lot of people overlook because there's so much else going on. And then the sixth film, we're going to talk about how that sixth film finally does justice and gives the female characters their due. And so that's what we're going to be covering. So let's dive right in. We're going to take a look at some of Brian Palma's fine direction, and then we're going to have a little discussion. So if we get some... Here we go. Oh, and so for those who haven't seen this in a long time, right? John Boyd plays Jim Phelps, who on the TV series was what? Good guy. What happens in this film that pissed off a lot of people? Jim Phelps is the baddie. And here's where Ethan Hunt figures that out. Because Jim Phelps is telling him, hey, I saw the mole, I saw the conspirator, it was the CIA director Kittredge, And John Voight's going to be telling the story while Ethan Hunt's figuring out, and Ethan Hunt's pretending he believes him while he's figuring out what actually happened. And John Voight thinks he's buying a hook, line, and sinker. I want you to look at the many layers of De Palma's direction here, the many layers of storytelling, and how he uses space, both foreground and background, to convey information efficiently. So, here we go. Okay, so, a little spoiler alert there. So, let's talk about De Palma's direction here. Let's talk about things that you noticed. What pops out at you? I think De Palma is a brilliant choice for this first film, but what do you all think?
It kind of takes me back to like the early Sean Connery Bond films when he's walking around Europe with the cobblestone streets. Just the way it's filmed, it gives that same kind of mood with the bridge and the opera houses and all that stuff going on. It just kind of triggers. It's a good way to start the series off.
Yeah.
In my opinion, it gives you that spy feeling.
Yeah, absolutely.
With a good pacing. The pacing for the intrigue parts and the action parts it's very well done with the dialogue, because there is a lot more dialogue and intrigue in this film than in the other ones. The other ones seem to be, especially as you move forward into the next film, this like rushing pace,
yeah,
of action, where the biggest action scene in this film is just right at the climax.
Yeah, it kind of reminds me, if anyone ever watched 24, the TV show 24, how action heavy the later season became, how there had to be a fight and a car chase and an explosion or a gunfight every hour. And that first season is actually the only one that feels realistic, because it takes so much time to just let the tension play out. Yeah. And Jack Bauer only kills like 5 people in that compared to 5 an hour. You know? and with this first Mission Impossible, you have an emphasis on the cerebral, which begs the question, the film when it came out was accused of being too complicated to follow, too complex. Audiences were upset about that. They liked the action, but there's a lot of backlash about that. Do you agree with that now? Has the film aged well? Do you still find it complex? Did you ever? Go ahead.
I watched it again, obviously, for the panel, just to make sure, and I think it's my second favorite one. But I'd like to see the sixth one again, because, again, maybe the pacing was just too fast. And I like how it slowed down and it told a story. Because I think a lot of the times action films want to rush you past things, because they're like, if we rush you past this, we don't have to explain it.
Yeah.
And you won't notice it until after you leave the theater, and you'll go, actually, wait.
That didn't make sense.
That didn't make sense.
I think that scene we just watched is cool because they're whispering. They're sitting across the table from each other,
yeah,
and they're whispering because they don't want anybody else to hear what's going on. And there's a lot of facial reactions and just like low-key acting, but it's super powerful without, yeah, yelling or running or doing it. Even when they're showing the flashbacks are kind of slow motion and understated.
Yeah. Well, yeah. Oh, go ahead.
Oh, I was just going to say, the brilliance of that scene I love is that Ethan is acting, you know, to him, even, yeah, though we're figuring out what he's figuring out at the same time. And it's such a cool way to film it, because you're there as he's there figuring all the details and how he actually carried it all out.
And when you look at it, it's very economic storytelling. Like, a lot, yeah, gets put into those 2 minutes. And when you have Ethan say, why, Jim, why? And Jim tells him why Kittredge did it. Mm-hmm. I mean, Ethan is at once asking, well, why would Kittredge do this? But he's also confronting his mentor with betraying him. And I love when he's like, how did he kill, I forget her name, but, and he sees Claire in his mind doing it, but he wants Claire to be innocent at this,
right,
point in the story. So he's like, no, he could have done it himself. He didn't need someone to do it, you know? So, very cool. I think people wanted to dumb, this was the year of Twister and Independence Day, both enjoyable films. I think Independence Day in particular has a special place in my heart, but no one would accuse either of those of being cerebral. We also had Eddie Murphy's Nutty Professor in 96, and summer blockbusters were not...
Hercules!
Summer blockbusters in 96 were not smart. And I think this film has aged very well. We're used to the Bourne films, we're used to other films that have a lot of densely layered plotting and a lot of storytelling going on that expect you to pay attention and reward you for paying attention. And maybe I was 15 when it came out, because I was 15. I was confused as hell. But now as an adult, I'm like, this isn't hard to follow. So
I think it ages well just because of the way it was filmed and the music they chose, because Mission Impossible 2 does not age as well. It's in the same vein as like like, I love the Bond movies too. When you watch the Brosnan movies, some of the music they choose. GoldenEye is good, yes. Tomorrow Never Dies, Die Another Day. The music they choose in those movies, like, kind of pulls you out of it a little bit.
So you're suggesting that the use of Limp Bizkit in Mission Impossible 2 ages the film?
It does for me a little bit. Yeah. Just
they're
this much.
Like Fred Durst, Jones, man. They just keep going.
Fred Durst brings back some, like, douche guilt from when I was a teenager. So, yeah, a little bit.
Okay, the score is definitely important to the pacing, especially if that scene where you have this underlying depressing, heavy tone as he just realizes that his mentor has completely crushed him. And then in the next movie we go, like you're saying, to this Brosnan sort of, you know, very super hyper-masculine, you know, hey, I'm going to get the lady. And, you know.
Yeah, well, let's go on to Mission Impossible 2. Quick note on the score. Danny Elfman scored the first film, and if you listen to that scene, he goes full Burton mode there. Like, it's an eerie, ominous, Edward Scissorhands, Sleepy Hollow type score. Okay, so we're going to dive in. So, Mission Impossible 2, I still really enjoy it. I know it's rubbish. I enjoy it as a guilty pleasure, the same way some of you can watch The Bachelor and The Bachelorette and enjoy it. If you watch those and think those are healthy relationships, come talk to me after the panel. But I enjoy Mission Impossible 2 for the same reason. So we're gonna, what I really wanted to highlight is that's the film where Tom Cruise decided, you know what, I'm gonna risk my life for your entertainment. And I do think that a lot of the people criticize the slow-mo, they criticize this and that, but there are some insane stunts in this, and I prepared a little edit of the motorcycle chase scene just to highlight some of the stunts.
Alright.
Now,
motorcycle jousting.
Yeah, I specifically didn't go to that part. We get our lights. Lights. Yeah. He skipped to the loom, my darling. Okay, well, we're just going to do this in the dark.
It just sets the mood.
I know. Yeah, it's great.
Okay.
No holding hands.
So, I don't care what you say about Mission Impossible 2. Him using a motorcycle as a shield, that's an awesome stunt. That's awesome.
Yeah. There's definitely awesome stunts in it.
The stunts are very good.
So let's briefly talk about MI2, very briefly, because our time is limited and I want to get to some of the other stuff. What are your thoughts on MI2? Quick reactions. Pros and cons.
MI2, a lot of fun to watch. You kind of, I watch it and kind of laugh a little bit. I always call it a Matrix Impossible. And I just wish there was like a Blu-ray feature where you could just like take the doves out or something. Just John Woo it a little bit.
Short of the Tom Cruise awesome, I'm going to try my kill myself for the entertainment stuff, I think you could replace him with Chuck Norris or Arnold Schwarzenegger and it would just feel like an 80s action movie.
Yeah.
And the stunts are that way. I mean, you've got cars that clearly did not pass safety ratings.
The explosions are amazing.
Yeah, it's a great action film, but I don't know if it's a great Mission Impossible.
He's got the same hair as you in that movie. The long, flowy hair.
Yeah, it shows you how dated I am.
What do you think of that, Mike, too?
You know, I really liked it. I like... I like him with Naya. It kind of shows, you know, more of his soft-hearted side. He didn't want to put her back in there with her former ex-boyfriend. He was a really bad guy.
It's really fun. Hitchcock's notorious.
Yeah. It's kind of neat how they did that. But, yeah, it's not my favorite of the franchise.
I think Hans Zimmer's score is awesome. There's a song called Injection where she injects herself. It is one of my favorite tracks of his. But, it's hokey. And I think Tom Cruise takes himself too seriously. I like the later films where he still does incredible stuff, but he's terrified. You know, he's freaking out, or he's nervous, or he's, you know, I like that sort of thing. Okay, good observations. We're going to go on to MI3. Philip Seymour Hoffman. This is not an action scene, but it is one of my favorite scenes in the series, so I hope you enjoy. Lights, por favor. Oh, man. Okay, so I want your opinions on Philip Seymour Hoffman's performance in this film, but if I may just say really fast, what a way to start a film.
Oh, yeah.
Especially coming from the second one where Ethan Hunt is too cool for school and always in charge, like the superhuman super spy, and here we see him broken and trying every spy trick he has and nothing. So tell me what you think of the scene, and let's talk about Philip Seymour Hoffman in this film.
That is a cool way to start it, because soon after that, you find out, oh, that's the woman he's engaged to. And you're like, what in the heck? Where is this going to go? And then you think, is she really going to die? And then there's the twist at the end, of course. But Philip Seymour Hoffman, I just wrote down watching, I was like, it's like the scariest human character since, like, Silence of the Lambs, you know?
Why is
just,
that?
Where's the rabbit's foot? He's just dead behind the eyes. There's, like, zero emotion until rage comes out. And then it goes back to just flat line and then rage.
Yeah.
There's just, there's no in between, I don't care about anything and I will kill you. I will kill everyone you love.
Yeah, I agree. He's scary in his intensity. And it's the first time we see Ethan with desperation and no plan. You know, yeah. He's always so in control in all the Mission Impossibles. But with his fiance on the line, it's just neat to bring out that character along with Philip Seymour Hoffman's deadly seriousness.
Yeah. It's like he was trying everything. It's in Paris. Yeah. I'll get it for you. I don't know where it is.
It's some of Cruise's best acting in the series as well. It's
amazing.
I mean, he's clearly being outclassed by what... You know, we lost an incredible talent when Hoffman, but yeah, he's just so great. He's so good, and as good as Cruise is in that scene, he's just being completely outclassed.
Yeah,
it's incredible to watch them battle that scene out, and it's good that he got outclassed because it makes him that much more terrifying for the rest of the movie. You're like, holy crap, this guy is a really bad guy. Like,
right. Well, you see, yeah. Ethan Hunt in the first film, he breaks into the CIA. He holds on to a train for your life. In the second film, he can do anything. He fraternizes with doves. He does all sorts of stuff. And you're looking at this, and you think, and so Ethan Hunt is like, it, like you said, always, he's always in control. Mm-hmm. And here you have this character who not only is in control over Hunt, he's borderline indifferent about Hunt. He's apathetic. The dead behind the eyes. If you watch Philip Seymour Hoffman, almost the whole movie, his self-perception that he is above Tom Cruise's character. Mm-hmm. Like, there's the scene on the bridge, and Hoffman's in the helicopter, he's flying away, and Hunt's, like, shooting at him, and then he runs out of bullets, and Hoffman just looks at him, and he doesn't even, a lot of villains would kind of smirk, and like, I got you, and Hoffman just kind of looks away, like, I don't even care.
Hair just waving in the wind.
Yeah. What do you think about the scene in the Vatican, where it's Hunt in the mask, but it's Hoffman playing Tom Cruise, like, it's Hoffman playing Ethan Hunt. What do you think of that?
It's so funny to see him, like, crawling through the catacombs and through...
And being all physical.
Right, right. Yeah, he's, like, leaping over things. And then he comes crawling through the bathroom, and there he is.
There's that great moment where the voice modulator hasn't kicked in yet.
Oh, yeah.
So he starts, and his bodyguard comes in, and starts having a major coughing fit, and the bodyguard comes in to help him. And he's like, nope, don't come in here, because the actual villain's right behind the door. And I love...
And you can tell the bodyguard's a little afraid of him, too. Like, okay, all right, you got it, boss.
So the door closes, and you have what's the actor's name? Jonathan Rhys Meyers? How do you pronounce his name? And you have Philip Seymour Hoffman do this look at him like that was close. And you talk about the dead eyes, but when he's Philip Seymour Hoffman playing Ethan Hunt, he smiles at Luther, like, thanks for congratulating on the engagement, like... So, sorry, go ahead.
And even when they're leaving, he goes back and talks to Maggie Q. And, you know, when she's kind of like, they're setting up like he's going to leave with her. He's a totally different person. Like,
yeah, he's like, nice work.
Like, how does Ethan Hunt possibly know how insane this person is?
Yeah.
He doesn't know that much about him. He just kind of knows what his voice is going to sound like. So he's just talking like a regular person would. But it wasn't passable when you find out what he's really like.
Yeah. The body language is, it's just another one of those... You can tell what a phenomenal talent he was, because when he's doing this, when he's running around, the way he's engaging, the way his entire body relaxes when it's Ethan Hunt inside that mask, and you really do feel like, oh, that's actually just Tom Cruise.
Yeah, you forget
that's
Tom.
Ethan Hunt, and then you go, well, actually, wow, it's just. It's one of the best scenes in the series. Again, this movie's just great.
Yeah.
Where you actually buy the mask more than any other time. Because of the performance.
Yeah, I agree. It's a shame that MI3 came out so close after the Tom Cruise couch jumping and Matt Lauer and everything. Because people were turned off by Tom Cruise, and a lot of people missed
an
excellent film. But it's gaining traction in the years since, I think.
I was thinking about when he's... handcuffed to the chair and he's trying to get up. I was like, he's trying to jump on the chair. I love this woman!
Now, there's lots more we can talk about MI3, in particular his relationship with Julia, but we're going to come around to that in the sixth film. So we're going to go ahead. Ghost Protocol, actually the clip I pulled was just the trailer, because it had a really awesome trailer. And so we're going to talk about how Ghost Protocol finally embraced, they flirt with it a little bit in the third film, but in Ghost Protocol they finally embrace IMF, Mission Impossible as a team, the way it was on the old series instead of it's the Tom Cruise show. And so we're going to take a look at that. Okay. And we are going to pick up the pace a little bit just to make sure we get to the sixth one. But what do y'all think of the team dynamic in Ghost Protocol, and in particular this team?
I think it kind of started a little bit in the third one, to be honest with you, when JJ took over. And I think they're like, there's something there. We need more of this. So I think it definitely adds to the movie, because it brings other things out of Ethan than just saving the day. It actually shows he cares about his team. And he cares about these individuals, and he also wants to trust people.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah, I agree. I think it's the first time we feel like Ethan has a family, you know, and they're all fighting together for the same thing, and he can finally trust everyone in his team that they're not all just agents in masks that are going to turn against him. Sorry. Am I quiet?
Just notes.
This is the film, you're right, in about the team, but this is the film where I wish there was more Luther, and then we get to the fifth one, and it's just like, oh, this is the team. These are my guys. These are my people. I want to see these guys in every film from now on, sort of like a CW team up kind of a show. I want to see them all. So
awesome.
The team up thing is kind of cool, because this is a movie where Lea Seydoux was in it, and she's actually Inspector. So that brings kind of a bridge between Bond, and then Jeremy Renner did a Bourne movie, so it kind of links all the movies together.
Yeah,
the other cool thing, what is the most boring thing on the planet? A parking structure. This movie made the parking structure cool.
the car factory / parking structure and everything. And I think it's fantastic. When you watch it, you realize other movies so far have team members doing stuff, but usually the tension revolves around what's ever happening with Ethan.
Mm-hmm.
And here you have, especially at the ending, you have everybody doing something crucial. If one person messes up, the whole mission goes south. And every person's job is getting botched up and going poorly. And so they all have to think on their feet. They have to work together. And it just adds to the tension considerably. And I love, in the fourth one, if you watch it, watching for this, every time they rely on technology, it fails. And so they have to use their team dynamics because the tech isn't helping them anymore. So, very cool. We're going to move on to the fifth one. I see the fifth one as much more of a buddy comedy than people even realize. So this is right after Ethan Hunt has drowned, and he's been brought back by Ilsa, and then she's going to take off. And you have Jeremy Renner and Ving Rhames are looking for their teammates. And let's go ahead and take a look at this. All right, so let's talk about the buddy comedy aspects or use of comedy in Rogue Nation.
I think when Tom Cruise did, remember the movie Night and Day with Cameron Diaz?
Mm-hmm.
I think when he did that movie, they realized, and he probably realized, because he's got a lot of say in what goes on, how entertaining it is, because he's been the world's greatest spy in several things, okay? Mm-hmm. And we've seen him be the world's greatest spy. But it's really entertaining to watch somebody that's just a regular person like you or me along for the ride, freaking out not only that he can do this, but how calm he is about doing it. Like, it's Tuesday for him.
Yeah, it gives us more of the layman in the car type of a situation. But I love the buddy cop dialogue that they have going throughout the whole movie, because while it's such a heavy movie, it lightens it up and kind of makes it so that you can get through it quicker.
High speed chase. You had to have the 4x4. You just had to have it.
I mean, I don't want to say any more about that because I think it's been so well said. So I'll say one thing, that I think that chase scene stands up with the great chase scenes, like in the Bourne,
mm-hmm.
or in Ronin.
Yeah.
The way that it develops, and you see like the professional courtesy of, hey, I'm chasing Elsa, but I don't want her to get shot, so I'll hit this guy in the motorcycle. And then everyone on the motorcycles behind are like, oh, so that's how it's going to be. So we'll shoot you. And then they split up, and the crazy stunts. don't know. It's just, yeah, it's still a really great action movie, despite the fact that they said, hey, this comedy can make it great too.
And that's, and I, as much as I enjoy the stunts in the second film, it's like the story stops so we can have a big action scene. And here you still get character through action, and you still get information through action, which I think is really great. And I just love, if you think of MI2 and how super cool Tom Cruise is that, to have him like try and jump a car and fail spectacularly, I think it's just a great little... But it makes you actually love Ethan Hunt.
Yeah.
You know? Okay, and for the last film, we're going to talk about how this boys' club, I mean, there are women in these films, but unfortunately it's a rotating door. It's been the James Bond films, and finally, and even Julia, who was such an integral character to the third film, and such an important, and in my opinion, beautiful love story for, or at least for this type of film, in the fourth film, it's like, oh yeah, well, we faked her death, and we're going to throw her in for 10 seconds. And so we're going to talk about how the sixth film finally gives the female characters their due, and just how many great female characters there are in the sixth one. And the clips I wanted to use aren't online yet, at least not legally. And so I actually pulled, I'm sorry to show you a second trailer, but man, this trailer's so good. And it does highlight the women, so we're just going to check this out and we'll talk about it. It's okay to applaud after that trailer. Okay, so in quick succession, I'm gonna name the big female characters in this film, and I'd like for you to talk about them and how this film does them justice. So we finally, Julia comes back, like really comes back, and we get some solid closure on that story. Ilsa, returning love interest, well, she wasn't even really a love interest in the first film, and even here it's very subtle. That's right. Not her, what I like is it's not her purpose in the film to be right. A love interest. And thank you. And then we have Angela Bassett's character, we have the White Widow, right, who is the daughter of Max, the arms dealer from the first film.
Right.
Am I leaving anyone out? Those are, yeah, okay, so here we go. Yeah. So let's dive in. Let's talk about the female characters of Mission Impossible Fallout.
I mean, I was glad to see, because Max was a great character in the first one.
Yeah.
And when they explained that I was her daughter, I was like, oh, okay, that's cool.
Did you notice how alike they sound?
Yeah, she sounded a lot like Vanessa Redgrave, who's an amazing actress. And, of course, you know, Ilsa, she's basically Britain's Ethan Hunt, you know?
Yeah.
She was the top agent until she got disavowed. And that was her main motivation, is, you know, to reverse the disavowation. I don't even know what the word is for that. But to get back in good graces with her country, because that's what she loves. She wants to be a spy for her country again.
I believe it's reavowed.
Reavowed. All right, we'll take
disavowation.
But it's not even like necessarily they're in love or anything. I think they probably do have feelings for each other, but they've been in life and death situations. It's not that far removed from the feelings that he's got toward Benji or Luther. So, I mean,
yeah,
that doesn't really...
Well, no, I think if there's a blossoming romance there, it's based on mutual respect.
Right.
And that, I mean, in the fifth film, there's not even a traditional end-of-the-movie kiss. She hugs him. And it's not a romantic hug. It's a hug of people who have been through a lot together.
I think the kiss is kind of Julia going, I think we could be friends.
Yeah.
That's kind of the kiss of the movie.
Yeah, I think, you know, with Julia, Ethan was always having to protect her, you know, and that's the thing that Ilsa brought, was somebody that could stand with him and fight with him and knew what he was going through.
Yeah.
And so it was kind of that partnership that could be a long-lasting one. And when she asked him to run away with her at the end of the fifth book, the fifth movie, Ghost Protocol, I mean Rogue Nation, and he declined, it kind of left hope for maybe Julia. And yeah. I think I wasn't the only one that was a little bit shocked when we see Julia and we're happy to see Julia, and then we see her husband come into the scene, and it's a little bit disheartening to realize that Ethan is not going to end up with her. It's not that happy ending we picture.
Right. But it's more true to life. I mean, if you live long enough, you have people in your life that you don't end up with, but you still care about greatly, mm-hmm. and you want them to be happy.
Yeah.
And even though Julia, she does come to, I mean, she shoots people, and she finds her strength through what she went through with Ethan. And I think that's an important thing about Julia, which I love when she gets in there with Luther and says, how can I help? And then Luther is messing stuff up and she's correcting him. And Ilsa says, oh, I like her.
Yeah, you're right.
You know, she's ready for action and saving the day.
Yeah.
And it's not a traditional love triangle, because there's no Julia versus Ilsa. It's like in a different world, Julia and Ilsa would be
friends.
Good friends, yeah.
There were sliding doors that just happened to cross each other.
Yeah.
What did Ilsa whisper to Julia What do you think?
Was it Julia whispering to Ilsa or Ilsa to Julia?
I think it was Ilsa.
It was Rosebud.
That was so fascinating, just to see they're kind of close. Mm-hmm.
Well, yeah, probably the same thing Scarlett Johansson whispered to Bill Murray at the end of Lost in Translation. The exact same thing.
42.
I think she was whispering, take care of him. That's what I think. I think if I remember, it was Julia whispering to Ilsa, and I think she could pick up on maybe there's something there. And she wants Ethan to be happy, you know?
Well, he has a good team. He has a good team that they depend on each other. And I think Jules can obviously see that, because it's like, look, he's going off there and he'll save the day, because he always does. But we still have a critical role here.
Yeah.
And we have to get everything ready, because when he's able to hit that switch, if we're not doing our jobs, it all falls apart. So as much as these films are very much like, hey, Tom Cruise is the main protagonist superhero, at this point, as we move forward, he has his team, and it's not all about him. We have these great female leads. We have these great comedic roles. I mean, Simon Pegg. Mm-hmm. It would be really sad if he didn't come back. And I miss Brandt in this film. I really did.
Yeah. I miss Paula Patton in the last two movies, because her character was awesome.
She was great.
Well, she was great.
Here's what I'm hoping. If they keep making them, they have a deep bench now. And on the TV series, they had a cast of characters, and they weren't all in every mission, but Jim Phelps would recruit who was the most specialist for it. And I would like to see that type of thing, where you see Paula Patton come back, you see the characters whose skill sets serve the mission in that film. That's what I'd like to see.
I want to see Luther in charge of IMF. So he's like dealing with all of the red tape and all that stuff. I think that'd be funny.
That would be really good.
Well, everyone, that is our time. Really fast, tell everyone where they can find you.
Oh, on Twitter at Mark Abel.
Yeah.
Go ahead.
My website, shrielsop.com.
Yeah, I'm on all the social medias and my podcast, Late to the Party with Travis Tate.
I'm actually a marriage and family therapist by day, and I do family film reviews for fun, so Your Family Expert is my site. Thank you all for coming. If you enjoyed this panel, let FanX know, because we'd like to do more clip panels like this in the future. So thank you all very much.
Five stars on the app.